A disciple asks the Rebbe, why does Torah tell us to place these words upon your hearts? Why does it not tell us to place these holy words in our hearts? The Rebbe answers, it is because as we are, our hearts are closed, and we cannot place the holy words in our hearts. So we place them on top of our hearts, and there they stay until one day the heart breaks and the words fall in.
William Moyers reading the epigraph from Broken, My Story of Addiction, Family, and Redemption. This is Cross Currents on Aspen Public Radio. My guest today, Will Moyers, he'll be speaking in Aspen on Thursday, September 17th for A Way Out at the Hotel Jerome. Moyers is the Vice President of Public Affairs and Community Relations at Hazelden Betty Ford Foundation. And later, Aisha Weinhold. She's the founder of the No Man's Land Film Festival, having its premiere in Carbondale on Saturday. But first, William Moyers. Moyers is the author of Broken, My Story of Addiction and Redemption, a memoir that became a New York Times bestseller and is now in its third printing. His new book, Now What? An Insider's Guide to Addiction and Recovery, was released in October 2012. Moyers will be speaking at the Hotel Jerome in Aspen on Thursday, September 17th for A Way Out. I asked Will to tell me about his story.
A critical, seminal moment in my story takes place in the summer of 1975 on the grounds of the venerable Aspen Institute, where I was working in building maintenance and lawn maintenance or ground maintenance in the summer of 75. And it was while working there that summer that I experimented for the first time with a mood or mind-altering substance. In this case, it was marijuana that was given to me by a coworker. I voluntarily and ingested it, and yes, I did inhale. And that's where a big piece of the rest of the story begins. My story, as I wrote in memoir, is called Broken, My Story of Addiction and Redemption. And the flashpoint for that slow but steady spiral downward really began on the grounds of the Aspen Institute when I smoked marijuana as a teenager.
Did you have family that had suffered from addiction?
That's a very good question, and it's a question that more families not only need to ask themselves, but need to answer among themselves. Mm-hmm. Because I did have addiction in my family, but we didn't really put our finger on it, much less talk about it, when I was growing up in the quiet suburbs of Long Island, New York. It turns out much later on, and as a direct result of my own experience, that my mother and father and I had some meaningful conversations about the reality that addiction had hit close to home for our family and in a way that had cost one of our family members their life back in 1967. Mm. So we never really talked about addiction growing up, in part because we didn't think we needed to. But hindsight being what it is, and as I began to move through the recovery experience along with my parents as the family members, we started to talk about the reality that addiction had hit close to home, which is part of the reason why in 1998 my parents did this formative five-part series on PBS called Moyers on Addiction, Close to Home. And from that documentary came even more conversation in our family and among lots of families around the country about the fact that addiction is something that most families have had an experience with firsthand.
That day in Aspen, that began a 20-year odyssey?
Yeah, 15. Yeah, it was a 20-year odyssey. That's correct.
You talk about at the event in Aspen or on this tour that you do around and in discussing these issues that you are committed to eliminating barriers to recovery. Can you tell me about what those are?
The barriers to recovery start with private shame and public intolerance. Addiction is a disease that is shrouded in stigma, and it's a stigma that is forged by the people who have it, those around them, and as society as a whole. And what is that stigma? Well, it's a stigma that addiction somehow is not a chronic illness, that addiction is a reflection on an inability to just say no, or that it stems from cultural or socioeconomic or educational shortfalls. There is a lot of frustration on the part of families who don't understand why the loved one who's an addict can't stop. And in truth, there are public policies in Colorado and around the country that don't really adequately recognize addiction for the illness that it is, or the reality that treatment does work and recovery is possible. So really, why I come to Aspen is really to plug into something that's bigger than me. And what that is what's happening at A Way Out, a community organization making a difference in the community, bringing everybody together to have a community conversation about addiction, treatment, and recovery. And I frankly can't think of anything more satisfying than going into Aspen, Colorado, or New York City, or Dallas, Texas, or the Twin Cities of Minneapolis and St. Paul, where I live, coming in and plugging in to a community conversation in a way that not just feels good, but actually furthers the dialogue and moves us closer to a solution in a community after I've packed my bags and gone home. Hmm.
Is the United States particularly bad at this discussion, or is this a worldwide phenomenon, the shame and the inability to talk about it?
Well, I don't know that the United States is any better or worse when it comes to addressing the public policy and the public health issues around addiction. I'm an expert, if you will, on what's happening in the United States, and I'll say that we've made some great strides over the last couple of decades, particularly around recognizing the science and the research and the treatment and the public policy that have helped us to move the ball down the court in recognizing that addiction is an illness that can't be cured yet, but it is an illness that has a solution. And that solution starts with public conversation like we'll have in Aspen. It includes prevention. It includes science and what research and what the medical community are doing. It includes treatment as a critical component of the solution, and most of all, includes the recovery community, people like me standing up and speaking out in places like Aspen and saying, hey, this is what addiction looks like, and this is what recovery can be.
This is Cross Currents on Aspen Public Radio. My guest is William C. Moyers. He's Vice President of Public Affairs and Community Relations at the Hazelden Betty Ford Foundation. He'll be speaking for A Way Out next week, Thursday, September 17th at 5 p.m. at the Hotel Jerome. Broken, My Story of Addiction, Family, and Redemption. I imagine you have pretty complicated, or maybe not, maybe pretty straightforward thoughts on Colorado and...
Yeah.
Our new status? Tell me about that.
Well, I'm torn because I know why the legalization effort got traction in places like Colorado. And I think that result reflects a public acknowledgement that the war on drugs has been a utter failure in this country, not just in this past generation, but going back 200 years. So I understand why the voters of Colorado wanted to make a change in drug policy around marijuana, because what that policy had been previously wasn't working, and it was falling disproportionately on those of colors other than white and those who might have been socio or economically disadvantaged. And it was resulting in the Pitkin County Jail and the Colorado Correctional Institutes being filled with low-level drug offenders whose problem wasn't so much breaking the law as much as it was that they have an illness that hadn't been properly treated. So I understand why the voters of Colorado took the steps that they took. But the red flag for me, both in my own personal experience and in working for the Hazel and Betty Ford Foundation, is that I am afraid that the voters of Colorado threw the baby out with the bathwater in terms of trying to resolve the problem simply through legalization. And I'm not sure, and I think the jury is still out, frankly, I'm not sure that we know yet the full implications, good or bad, around the legalization of marijuana in Colorado.
I think
and let me just say this, too.
Mm-hmm.
I worked for this organization, that's been around since 1949, and we rarely take public positions on drug or alcohol issues that are not directly related to treatment, which is our core competency.
Mm-hmm.
But we did. Our board of trustees, a year and a half ago, after I made a presentation at the board, our board of trustees voted to take a public position that our organization would oppose the legalization of marijuana in the United States.
Mm-hmm.
And we did that because we know among our own patients that a certain percentage of them find marijuana to be as addicting a substance as is cold beer, warm whiskey, pain medication, or heroin. And we don't believe as an organization, nor do I believe as an individual who has been there and done that, that legalizing another drug of misuse is a good idea when our nation has never been able to get its arms, its public policy, around the most used and abused substance in this country, alcohol.
Right.
From drunk driving to unemployment to violence, our country has done a lousy job, frankly, of coming up with effective public policy to deal with the consequences of alcohol.
Can you tell me about your thoughts regarding AA? And there's been a bit of press recently that it may be a one-size-fits-all solution to an inadequate solution for some people. I'd love to know what you think about that.
Carolyn, thanks for asking me that question, because it's one I don't get enough, and I feel that it is as critical an issue as is, legalization, or does prevention work, or all those other things I talk about.
Mm-hmm.
Look, there are many pathways to recovery. I happen to walk the walk along a series of steps that works for me and has worked for many millions of people. But the federal government estimates that are roughly 23 to 25 million people in this country who consider themselves to be in recovery from alcohol or drug problems. At the same time, AA as an institution, or the 12 steps as a pathway of recovery, have always indicated that roughly 2 to 3 million people consider themselves to be members of that kind of recovery. So where are the rest of them? My point is, there are many pathways to recovery. The 12 steps works for some. Church works for others. Exercise works for others. Medication works for others. And what I always say is that there is no one-size shoe that fits all when it comes to the pathway that we walk. But what is critical is that whatever that pathway is, whatever that treatment is, it must be a course of action that treats addicts and alcoholics with dignity and respect. As long as it does treat people with dignity and respect, I don't have any issue with how people recover. I do know this, though. Recovery treatment is a viable solution to the cunning, baffling, and powerful illness of addiction. And whatever kind of treatment we offer addicts and alcoholics, as long as it empowers them with personal responsibility and gives them a sense of real hope, I'm okay with it. Mm.
Does the Hazelden Betty Ford Foundation, what's the right word, proffer up alternatives to AA? And
no, and no, and you know, we don't even proffer up AA. Well, here's what we are. And by the way, there was a good article in Time or Newsweek magazine about a year ago about treatment of addiction, particularly opiate addiction, and how institutions like ours, Hazel and Betty Ford, how we're changing our treatment modality. And we've taken a lot of criticism for it. But here's the thing. We're not AA. AA is not treatment any more than Hazelden is AA. Mm. AA is a way to recover, and treatment at Hazelden is a way to get into recovery. But we are a organization that embraces the entire 12-step modality of treatment. We hang those 12 steps on the walls of every one of our units from coast to coast. So I'm not going to for a moment pretend that we don't embrace the abstinence-based 12-step philosophy of recovery. Why? Because we know that addiction is an illness of the mind, the body, and the spirit. And it's not enough just to stop using. That's easy. I stopped 1,000 times. It's hard to stay stopped. And to stay stopped requires a series of steps that are all about personal responsibility, cleaning up the messes of the past, making amends, and trying to help the other addict and the alcoholic. At the same time, we have come to recognize that the medical community has critical tools that can be used even in a 12-step holistic treatment to better somebody's chances of recovering. To wit, we are now using medications to treat some of our difficult opiate addicts in treatment. And we're not keeping them on those medications forever, but even while we are treating them with opiate derivatives, we are encouraging them to go to abstinence-based 12-step meetings. Because we believe that whatever the tool, as long as that tool is grounded in science, as long as that tool is one that treats the addict as a human being, then why wouldn't we want to include more tools from medications to yoga to a spiritual connection to whatever else it takes? The Hazel and Betty Ford Foundation recognizes not just the complexities of the illness, but the complexities of the treatment, and even in the complexities of the recovery from it.
This is Cross Currents on Aspen Public Radio. My guest is William C. Moyers. He's Vice President of Public Affairs and Community Relations at the Hazelden Betty Ford Foundation. He'll be speaking for A Way Out next week, Thursday, September 17th at 5 p.m. at the Hotel Jerome. Broken, My Story of Addiction, Family, and Redemption. You have three children.
Yes.
I was just reading in the last 6-8 months about yet another drug, a new one called Spice, I think. Does it scare you? It almost feels like there's this ramping up on the other side of yet new and more sophisticated and more terrifying substances out there for society to sample. Do you feel a little like a whack-a-mole?
It isn't the substances really that scare me as much as it is the way that our young people people, including my children, are learning about them or gaining access to them. The internet is ubiquitous.
Right.
And whether it's alcohol or legal marijuana or Percocet out of somebody else's medicine cabinet or new drugs like spice, our children and our grandchildren are exposed in ways that we never were before. That's why a critical component of the story that I will bring to Aspen is the responsibility of the audience that night and the responsibility of your listeners to speak honestly and openly to your own children and to your own grandchildren about your own experiences with substances growing up. Many of us, particularly us baby boomers, are of that generation where alcohol and other substances flowed freely in and out of our bodies. Most of us who smoked marijuana or drank at the age of 18 or used cocaine even in the 1980s, most of us used them and got away with it and then stopped. Some of us, maybe one in 10 of us, like me, used those substances and became addicted. And here's the thing I think that's a big twist from when I smoked marijuana in July of 1975. The marijuana and other drugs of today's generation are far more toxic and legal than they were in the old days.
Right, exactly.
That's the reality of it. The way that farmers or growers have propagated and cultivated marijuana is based in science, you know, and in all the other things that genetically modified crops and better applications of fertilizer and so on result in a better bumper yield, you know.
Right.
And when I was smoking marijuana in Colorado, listen, not everybody who smokes marijuana gets addicted to it. I would never suggest that any more than people who watch the Denver Broncos game this Sunday who drink beer are going to become addicted to it. The reality is about 1 in 10 of us is directly impacted by the substances that we ingest, be they legal or illegal. 1 in 10 of us, 10% of the population. But what the key is the nature, it's the power of the substances that we're ingesting today that, frankly, scare me more than any other new invention of a drug, and that the internet is what it is to our children and our grandchildren makes it even more imperative that we, as the older generations, talk about our own experiences.
Thank you so much for your time. I really appreciate
it.
William Moyers, author of Broken, My Story of Addiction, Family, and Redemption, presented by A Way Out, speaking on Thursday, September 17th at the Hotel Jerome. Coming up next, Aisha Weinhold. She's the founder of No Man's Land Film Festival, an all-female adventure film festival in Carbondale.
I'm Julie. I'm a student, and I'm 22 years old. Feminism. Am I on a curse in this thing? I think feminism stands for equality across gender identities. There's this common notion that feminism is this women's movement, but really involves people of all different genders.
No Man's Land Film Festival premieres September 12th in Carbondale. I asked Aisha Weinhold to tell me how the whole thing started.
It was about 4 or 5 years ago. I had decided to do an alternative college program, and I went sailing from California to Hawaii. And you have bow watch every night. And at this point, I was bored with the college life I had, and I wanted to do something new. And first, I thought I wanted to be a professional athlete. And it just hit me all of a sudden that the world should have an all-female adventure film festival. And I'd seen a film at Five Point called Deer and Yonder, and it's all these different women's relationship with the sea. And I knew then and there that was just a world I wanted to be a part of, but I didn't know how to navigate that. I was 18 or 17.
Are there enough women's adventure films out there to turn it into a film? Obviously there are, but was it an issue trying to find content?
Yeah, I actually didn't do anything production-wise with the film fest for 2 years because everyone said there's not enough content.
Yeah.
You won't find anything, or it'll be like very emotional or very soft. And everyone had these ideas of what I was going to find. And so it was so cool to spend 2 years, and we have at least 500 films that we actually have that are skiing and running and climbing and epic. And then we have the emotional, and then we have a whole array that you get with men's adventure films too.
Are they both feature women athletes and also made by women?
Yeah, so there's both. The only rule we have is that the main feature has to be a woman. And we have a surfing film, a skiing film, and a climbing film, two of which we'll see on tour, not at the premiere, but that are fully, they're the first ones to be totally completed by women.
And tell me about the premiere.
So the premiere is September 12th at the Carbondale Community School. We actually partnered with the Sendigo Autism Services because we're not technically nonprofit yet, and we wanted to work with a nonprofit that would benefit from what we're doing. And eventually I'd like that to turn into working with a women-specific program. And Roaring Fork Beer Company gave us a bunch of beer. And we have Dos Gringos in Carbondale, Ragged Mountain Sports, Cripple Creek Backcountry, Aloha Mountain Cyclery. Coalition Snow is actually a company that I work for. It's an all-women's ski company, so they make skis by women, for women. We're going to tour a little bit this winter, hoping we'll tour to Jackson and maybe go to Utah and follow the snow. So
there's a trailer that looks like women who are probably my age now, and they look... It looks like it's maybe the 70s or 80s.
Yes, that's from Pretty Faces, a film that we're not going to show at the premiere. We decided to show it at the tour. But I don't know if you've heard of it or seen it. It's an all-female ski film produced, edited. And so we're showing the surf one that's all done by women. But this movie is awesome. It's the first ski film I've seen that has huge lines and is really epic and is women crushing, which you don't see all the time.
So what will people see at your premiere? How many different films?
We have 13 different films, and I can't tell you exactly what they are.
Okay.
Mostly because I can't remember. But we have some of my favorite films. We're showing Gnarly in Pink, which is these, have you heard of this?
Nope.
It's these young girls, these three young girls who are 6 to 7, and they're skateboarders. And they're awesome. And so they show them the skate park with all the boys, and they're hilarious and are doing their nails and have glitter and then shred that one. And then on the other end of the spectrum is a film that's made, edited, directed by this one woman. She's 65 years old. Her and her girlfriends live in Australia. They're 50, 60-some, and 65, and they wanted to pick up surfing. And so they started to learn then, and it's their story of them in the water and navigating the surf world. And that's my favorite. It's amazing.
Yeah, sounds touching.
Mm-hmm.
Are you still skiing a lot, or is this taking over your full-time life?
No, luckily, I teach skiing, so I get to be on the mountain every day, which is great. I can't wait for the snow to come. I'm so excited. We just pulled all of our skis out of storage, and I do a bunch of ski mountaineering races, and our first race is November 24th. I'm starting to train for that and get ready, and it feels so close.
Tell me about your partner.
So Steve is my husband, and I brought him on this year because for a while I was working with a bunch of my girlfriends, which was awesome. Actually, I guess I had a lot of trouble navigating how to have a female-centered, oriented festival, but that was still appealing to men. And I think it's so important to see a man working in like a feminist-based industry, kind of.
Aisha Weinhold is the founder of No Man's Land Film Festival. Good luck and congratulations.
Thank you.
This is Cross Currents on Aspen Public Radio. If you missed the show or would like to hear it again, go to our website, aspenpublicradio.org. Have a great afternoon.